From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Friday's storm over President Trump's emergency declaration to repurpose money from the military to build his border wall has not died down. Democrats in Congress are expected to introduce a resolution expressing disapproval, which is expected to pass, though probably not survive a presidential veto. And lawsuits are gathering with the storm clouds. We have presidential historian Douglas Brinkley standing by, but we start with USA Today immigration reporter Alan Gomez. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Rob.
And give us a sense, who's filing lawsuits?
Well, this is going to really be a lot of lawsuits that end up getting filed. We've already had a couple filed, one by an advocacy group called Public Citizen on behalf of several Texas landowners who might have their land taken from them through eminent domain to build the border wall. We've had a lawsuit filed by the Citizens for Biological Diversity that are seeking documents that were used to formulate this national emergency. But the big ones really are going to come in the coming days. We have the ACLU and other immigration advocacy groups that are really looking into this and preparing a lawsuit that they say they'll file early this week. And then we have another one from state's attorneys general. That one's being led by California. And already, just in the last couple of days, we've gotten states from New Mexico, Oregon, Minnesota, New Jersey, Hawaii, Connecticut, Colorado, all signing on and saying that they will be part of that lawsuit. And so this is probably going to be tied up in the courts for some time.
Well, even the president's counsel, Kellyanne Conway's husband, this is George Conway III, who's a conservative lawyer and a Trump critic, tweeted out that Mr. Trump must know that he's going to lose because Trump did say he expected to go all the way to the Supreme Court. And therefore, he knows he's violating the Constitution and laws he's sworn to uphold. Is he, though? Because we know the Constitution does mandate that it's Congress that appropriates money, funds. But there was a 1976 law that introduced the power of the presidential emergency resolution. So we're presuming that's going to be the president's defense. It already has.
Exactly. And this is, as we've seen so many times, we're entering into uncharted territory when it comes to the president and his use of executive authority. The problem is there is no definition of a national emergency in U.S. law.
Yeah.
A lot of deference is given to the executive, to the president, to declare a national emergency. And courts have historically given presidents a lot of latitude when it comes to this. And when we finally end up before the Supreme Court, that's where the president himself said he feels comfortable that he's going to win. And we just have to look at recent history to show an example of that. His travel ban, that was struck down by several courts, but ultimately was upheld by the Supreme Court. In that case as well, we had a situation where his words were working against him. A lot of lower courts, a lot of judges had said that he displayed a racial animus when formulating that travel ban. But in the end, the 5-4 conservative majority of the court ended up siding with the president.
Well, what about there's been huge discussion on even the use of the emergency resolution. There was that exchange on Fox News Sunday with host Chris Wallace and White House senior policy advisor Stephen Miller over immigration statistics that the Trump administration is using to justify the emergency declaration. Let's listen to a little.
Four times as many people were coming across the border
then,
in 2000 as now.
Then,
so why is that a natural
back then,
emergency?
95% could be turned around in a matter of days as a result of loopholes.
And it went on. Miller was repeatedly asked, where is the emergency? And he often said, well, we don't know what we don't know. In other words, there may be people coming and we don't know, and that's why they don't show up in the statistics. Alan, you have studied this deeply. What are the statistics about border crossings?
I mean, both sides in that case do make a correct point. Overall illegal immigration, overall apprehensions at the southern border are at historic lows. But what Miller squeezed in there was the fact that the nature of illegal immigration or the nature of migration across that border has changed, wherein before it used to be predominantly single men from Mexico coming over here to work. And now the majority are family units from Central America that are seeking asylum. So that has changed the way that the U.S. government has had to respond to it. They have been overwhelmed. Their systems are not prepared for that. But do family units coming to the border, presenting themselves at ports of entry to request asylum, crossing illegally and literally finding Border Patrol agents so that they can turn themselves in and request asylum, that is different. But is that a national emergency? And that's the question that we're going to be seeing in courts, and that's what's going to be played out.
Alan Gomez, USA Today immigration reporter, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now let's bring in historian Douglas Brinkley, professor of history at Rice University. Doug, welcome. Happy President's Day. We know this is a big day for you.
Yes, it is. I went for President's Day last Friday to my middle school daughter's class and gave four different lectures on presidential history. So today I'm kind of relaxing. I feel like I've done my due diligence.
Well, we want you to do some more because we want to put this in context. Let's listen to another clip from Stephen Miller's interview with Chris Wallace about the emergency declaration. This is when Wallace was trying to press him on other cases. Let's listen.
Can you name one case where a president has asked Congress for money, Congress has refused, and the president has then invoked national powers to get the money anyway?
Well, this current situation...
Just yes or no, sir.
The current situation pertains specifically to the military construction...
He went on to talk about Belarus and other times there's been emergency declarations, but he couldn't really answer that question, so we put it to you. Has this happened before?
No, this is another one of those unprecedented Donald Trump moments. Now, of course, there have been precedents that have used emergency powers, particularly in wartime. You know, Abraham Lincoln in the Civil War and FDR. What's unique about this is that Donald Trump simply got shot down in Congress and wants to grab money and move it into a different kitty. And the power of the purse belongs to Congress, not the White House. And if he's lucky, it'll get to the Supreme Court, and there he might have a chance. But it's a lot of gambling, and he's eating up a lot of oxygen on doing this sort of unprecedented end run of Congress and the Constitution.
Well, just to follow up on your points there, this 1976 law has been used about five dozen times. 31 of those emergencies are active, but as the New York Times explains, most of them dealt with, as you said, foreign crises or involved freezing property or blocking trade. The White House, when asked for, you know, in a follow-up, could they cite any times that they've been used by presidents to spend money without legislative approval? They only found once by President George Bush in 1990, but this was, you know, responding to a new event, the Persian Gulf War, and by his son, President George W. Bush, in 2001 after the terrorist attacks in New York. So it wasn't as much as if Congress denied. It was as if they needed to immediately respond to new events.
That's right. And if I had to pick an analogy to this, in some ways, I would look at Iran-Contra when Ronald Reagan did not like the news that Congress didn't want to fund the Contras in Nicaragua. And instead, his administration started finding ways to get funding for the Contras. So this isn't like that because this is quite transparent, Donald Trump's declaration. But it's not being met with great enthusiasm, even in the Republican Party.
Well, he does have supporters, and we're going to get to that. But talk more about this particular president in this particular time, because he has made threats before that others feel were unconstitutional. For instance, announcing a plan to end the constitutional guarantee of birthright citizenship by executive order, or declaring on the campaign trail that Hillary Clinton would be in jail if he were president. That's when we started getting all those lock her up comments. And people have been pointing out that this national emergency comes with a lot more special provisions than Americans might know. There's about 100, including he can activate laws allowing him to shut down electronic communication inside the U.S. or freeze Americans' bank accounts. Talk about concerns of presidential power at this point.
That's what we're dealing with. It's about presidential power. And Donald Trump loves the word power, the idea power. He likes mobilizing and marshaling his own power. The problem is he has really no sense of American history or constitutional law. His whole business career has been as a gut player. That's done him well. You just make a decision. He sees this right now as a political problem.
Well, polls show that most Americans do oppose this emergency declaration. Even one by Fox News found 56% against it. That included 20% of Republicans. And yet, as we said, the president has his fierce supporters. This morning, conservative radio talk show host Chris Buskirk spoke to Morning Edition, said he's very much in favor of the president's national emergency declaration because of the politics of it. Let's listen.
The president obviously is starting to think about the 2020 reelection campaign. And if you are going to make this a centerpiece of the campaign, which obviously the president wants to do, then you need to make the political case. You need to try and persuade people that this was the right thing to do.
He mentioned, you know, the 2020 campaign, that's what this is about, politics. Your sense of that?
Well, I agree with that.
But he said that as a positive.
Yeah, I see it as a negative. At least this way, he presents himself as a fighter on border security, and he lives for another day, most likely in 2020, where I think this issue is going to be front and center yet again, and they'll look for cases of a crime made by somebody from Central America mm-hmm. on American soil and try to use that as the law and order, control our own borders message of the Trump reelection campaign.
Crimes which are horrific for the victims and their families, but most analysts don't say constitute a national emergency. Doug Brinkley, professor of history at Rice University, putting some of the recent news in context for us. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Some news that caught our eye overseas today, as Prime Minister Theresa May and British lawmakers argue over their Brexit from the European Union. Sky News is reporting that Honda is set to announce tomorrow that it will close a factory in Western England in 2022. Honda makes its Civic model at its factory in Swindon, 70 miles west of London. 3,500 people work at the plant. Honda hasn't confirmed the plans, but Justin Tomlinson, a Conservative member of Parliament, said today that he spoke with the Japanese car maker, and he also said he was told that Honda's plan was due to global trends in auto sales, not Brexit. But again, Honda hasn't publicly commented. The plant produced about 160,000 Civics last year. 90% of them were sent to the U.S. and the European Union. Britain's largest trade union said shutting down the plant in Swindon would be a shattering body blow to the heart of UK manufacturing. We will follow this story. But let's take a break from all the news for a few minutes with a terrific book that's now going to be a little easier to carry. It's Lionel Shriver's Property, which is now out in paperback. Now, Lionel does not shy away from the uncomfortable. Her 2003 novel, We Need to Talk About Kevin, centered on a mother confronting her own possible culpability in her son's school attack. Then there was 2010's So Much for That, which addressed the U.S. healthcare system. 2014's Big Brother, which looked at obesity and our relationship with food. And then last year, Lionel Shriver took on the often wince-inducing role of stuff, our property, and its effect on our relationships in her first short fiction collection. In one story, a couple's home renovation destroys the marriage. An embezzler flees justice and his wife, but the island paradise he settles in becomes a living hell. Long ago lovers, now best friends, are torn apart when the new girlfriend doesn't want the old girlfriend around. The book again is called Property, Stories Between Two Novellas. We spoke with Lionel Shriver last April when it first came out. Lionel Shriver, welcome back.
It's nice to talk to you again, Robin.
Boy, I love this collection, and often so painful to read.
I beg to differ. You know, in comparison to my novels, this book is a walk in the park.
Well, actually, there's a lot of humor in it. But start with The Standing Chandelier. It's about Gillian Frisk and Weston Babansky. Frisk and Baba, they call themselves. Best friends after a brief sexual encounter years earlier. They talk about everything. They play tennis together. They are the perfect best friends. Then enter Baba's new girlfriend, Paige. Suddenly, unbeknownst to Gillian, Paige starts planting seeds of doubt about her. And bam, Baba breaks off their friendship. It's heartbreaking. So why drive this to that painful end?
I'm interested in asking the question as to whether or not men and women can ever just be friends. Mm-hmm. And I'm very sympathetic with everyone in this scenario, and that includes the girlfriend who's new on the scene and is trying to get a feel for this close friendship that goes back 25 years. And it's like, who is this woman? Mm-hmm. And she immediately takes a dislike to a woman that she perceives as potentially a romantic rival, but more to the point, a rival for intimacy with her boyfriend. She doesn't like how close they are.
Well, and the property in this story, I think, is the standing chandelier, which is this bizarre piece of art that Jillian made and presented to them for their wedding present. And it was such a symbol of her weirdness and quirkiness that at first Paige is like, oh, I hate that thing. Then they both decide that they want it and they keep it. So they keep her wedding present, don't allow her to come to the wedding. Property. Talk about that idea.
Well, I'm interested in property as a projection of the self. You know, when you buy a house, for example, that's you. That's your house. Mm-hmm. One of the most interesting things about the concept of ownership is the fact that it is mostly, if not primarily, defined by the fact that not only is this yours, but it's not anyone else's. Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of patrolling of the boundary between you and other people. Mm-hmm. And that's why the concept of property, of ownership, becomes so emotionally charged.
Well, so the property in that story actually could have been Baba, the man.
That's what they're really tussling over. Yeah. And that's what Paige, the girlfriend who becomes his wife, is really getting to keep.
Yes, it's very sad. In another story, there's parents of a middle-aged child who will not leave the home. He's happy
there.
Which
is a pretty commonplace situation.
Very common. It's throat-tightening, but it's hilarious. They decide, well, they're just going to throw him out. Instead, he lives on the front lawn with all his belongings, becomes an internet sensation. People start picketing on his behalf. How can you throw him out? He becomes this worldwide sensation. They are cowed not only into bringing him back into the house, but they give up their master bedroom to him, his girlfriend, and their new baby. What a horror.
I had great fun with that story. I'm interested in the fact that when you look at that situation, you would think that the parents were in a position of power. But the trouble is that when you have a heart, advantage is a disadvantage. Their son's very helplessness, his weakness, he can't survive in the outside world. That means that he has all the power, ironically, because that dependency makes him vulnerable and helpless and someone who needs to be taken care of. And if you're going to be a decent parent, you don't abuse that. I'm also interested in that situation of overlapping territory. Most parents will recognize this. If you have an adult child living at home, it becomes a little awkward whose house it is. After all, when your children are growing up, your house is their house. But by convention, they leave the nest and you get your house back. But if they don't leave home, there's a real tension between who owns that house in an emotional way and even in a who determines what happens to what room. Can they raid the refrigerator or are they expected to go shopping for their own food? It becomes complicated. And of course, that is great stuff for a fiction writer.
And is it great stuff that you are seeing you have borrowed from your own stories? And you talked about your novels being, you know, lacerating at times. And one of them, Big Brother, which looked at morbid obesity, you had a brother who died of morbid obesity, you told us when you were here before. You know, how much as a writer are you excavating your own stories?
I think all writers excavate their own lives. I mean, after all, you only have your own experience. So everything I know about the world is through my little lived life.
Well, how much do these stories reflect your life? In another one, a man has a meltdown in a TSA airport line. You also could have lost your temper at security at an airport.
Which is not a good idea.
Have you actually gone to the denouement that he did, which was being dragged into a back room?
I haven't gone that far, but I do have a temper on me, and you do not want to go through airport security with me. I have very little patience for stupid rules that don't work.
So that is you.
I exaggerated my own tendency, and in some ways I wrote that to chastise myself, to please, please, please keep your mouth shut.
In other words, do it here on the page and then show the terrible consequences of that and don't do it yourself.
Right.
Right.
The point of that scene was that the character had been under his elderly father's thumb for years. And one more time, he's going back to visit his father, who is ostensibly at death's door. Mm-hmm. And he's very resentful. He's made this trip over and over again, and the guy always pulls through. And then he finally draws the line and stands up for himself. in the worst possible place to stand up for yourself in all of the United States, airport security.
Yeah. And by the way, the property in this story, a small chapstick, which is the offending thing in his pocket, which has gotten him pulled over in the first place. And as he sits in this detention that he's now in, that chapstick becomes a connection to his father.
That particular detail is, strangely enough, quite autobiographical because my father always used those plain chapsticks, you know, the ones with the black wrapper.
Sure.
And that smell and even that texture, that because it's especially waxy, I always associate with him and being kissed on the cheek as a kid. He would leave behind that smell, which is very masculine to me.
This is your writing that we've just come to love. After her breakup with her friend Baba in the first story we talked about, Jillian would migrate on her own to their tennis bench, kneeling on the ground, resting her forehead on the rough paint-peeling front slat in a position that only could have been called prayerful, and then she wailed from the part of the body from which one is taught to sing opera. The father of the son who won't move out, who spends hours on a website, manhole.com, which really is for people who love manhole covers. The father asks his wife, "Do you not like our son?" She says, "No, it's not dislike. All that idleness is oppressive. It lowers the barometric pressure of the whole house." Great writing. But it's in this short story form. How do you know? How do you know when something, a bolt of lightning hits you? Oh, a couple laid back, suddenly they buy a house, start renovating it, and he turns into, you know, a fascist, practically. You know, how do you know that that's a short story and not a novel?
A short story you can kind of hold in your head, and I'm likely to conceive of it pretty much beginning, middle, and end. A novel is much more unwieldy, and there's something about it that seems intrinsically unresolved, whereas the short story is more like a little gift, and it's already all wrapped up. It is a complete experience in a discrete period of time, and that can be very satisfying.
Well, these definitely are gifts, and they definitely are, although people will be reading them screaming half the time, "No, don't do that." You know, it's just property. That's Lionel Shriver. The new book is Property. Lionel, thank you so much.
Oh, I really enjoyed talking to you.
Our conversation with Lionel Shriver last April. Property comes out in paperback this week.
Here and Now is supported by LegalZoom, who want you to know that if you want to make 2019 the year you finally start a business or secure your family's future, LegalZoom can help. With their network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, LegalZoom can help you navigate your legal needs, from wills and trusts to LLCs, trademarks, contract reviews, and more. And the best part is, LegalZoom is not a law firm, so they don't charge by the hour. More at LegalZoom.com/now.
More than 3 months after the midterms, North Carolina's 9th Congressional District still doesn't have representation. You'll remember the Republican Mark Harris appeared to beat the Democratic candidate Dan McCready by just over 900 votes. But allegations that a Republican supporter filled out mail-in ballots for voters prompted the State Board of Elections to launch an investigation. That board is meeting right now to hear evidence of this alleged ballot tampering and to decide whether to trigger a whole new election. Rusty Jacobs is politics reporter for WUNC. He stepped out of that hearing with his phone. And Rusty, the Republican Mark Harris, as you well know, won 61% of mail-in ballot votes in Bladen County, North Carolina, despite only 19% of those voters being registered Republicans. Suspicious, yes, but what's the evidence?
Well, the evidence, the board, the executive director overseeing the investigation that's been underway, says they will show that there was an orchestrated campaign by this operative, McCray Dallas, who's here today for this hearing, working for the Harris campaign, sends workers out to harvest or collect absentee ballot request forms, then to go back out to the people who requested those forms to get the actual absentee ballots, and then to even in some cases falsify the information. And we've already heard from Lisa Britt, who's one-time stepdaughter of McCray Dallas, whose mother was once married to him and still is close to him, and testified that she did indeed in many cases sign the witness boxes on these absentee ballots when she did not actually witness the information being inserted and delivered those absentee ballots to McCray Dallas, to eventually go to the board, but that's a violation of state law.
Sure is. Well, the hearing could go on for as long as 3 days, and North Carolina law gives the elections board the power to trigger a new election if they find that irregularities or improprieties have occurred. We've heard some allegations. They also could say that, you know, the Republican Mark Harris with 900 votes, despite the alleged ballot tampering, is the winner. So what will happen? You know, what's your sense of what will happen?
Well, the last thing you said, I mean, that's exactly what Republican Party members, Republican Party officials are saying. Say, look, even if there's some wrongdoing here, it has to be just about 905 votes or more that were falsified. It has to be, in other words, it has to be a precise number that could actually reverse the outcome. On the other hand, the law and Democrats say that, no, what you need is a taint of wrongdoing enough to undermine the reliability or the confidence of wrongdoing in this particular election. Mm-hmm. So whether it's a taint or a precise number, that's the debate. That's going to be for the board to decide. The board could end up in a kind of a deadlock where, in other words, it's a five-member board, three Democrats, two Republicans. Three Democrats could decide, no, we are not certifying Mark Harris. The two Republicans could say we would certify, but you need 4-1, a supermajority. You need one Republican to join the other Democrats to call for a new election. So we could be in a deadlock where there's no certification but no new election. Ultimately, U.S. House has the authority to jump in here and take over the investigation and decide on their own whether to seat Mark Harris.
Well, and it's a democratically controlled House of Representatives now, which might refuse also to seat Mark Harris. And meanwhile, the voters in North Carolina's 9th District wait, and they've been without representation in Congress. Rusty Jacobs, WNC political reporter, stepping out of that hearing of the Elections Board there in North Carolina to tell us what's going on. Rusty, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And again, it might take 3 days for them to decide. This month, a local school board voted to retire the school mascot for Cedar High School in Cedar City, Utah. By a 3-2 vote, the board ruled that at the end of the school year, the Cedar High School's mascot and team name will no longer be the Redmen. That's also the nickname since 1927 of the sports teams at McGill University in Montreal. And over the decades, stereotypical Native American imagery started to accompany the name. So in the last several months, students at McGill started a movement to put the Redmen nickname there away for good as well. Matthew Stock of NPR's Only a Game has that story.
Tomas Jerusik is a member of the Blackfoot Confederacy, a group of indigenous tribes in western Canada. About 25% of his hometown of Whitehorse, Yukon, is indigenous. But when Tomas first arrived at McGill University in the fall of 2016, he was one of only about 150 indigenous students out of nearly 28,000 undergrads.
There were these pockets where I saw myself reflected, but it almost felt more isolating now that I think about it. I had never really felt as othered as I did here at McGill.
Before long, Tomas found a place where he did fit in, the varsity crew team.
It was amazing, like an instant family, almost. I was just so lucky to get to travel around Eastern Canada with some of your best friends.
Varsity sports at McGill and other Canadian universities aren't as high profile as they are in the U.S., so it wasn't until later that fall that Tomas first came in contact with McGill's nickname, the Redmen.
I went to a football game. That's when I first heard it chanted.
Tomas says he had heard Redmen used as a slur growing up. He was shocked to hear it on his college campus.
Had this reaction, this visceral reaction. And it just struck me as so archaic, outside of the image that McGill was trying to project, or the institution McGill was trying to be.
Tomas began learning more about the history of the Redmen name.
Seeing old pictures of jerseys and helmets, and just listening to the stories of some of the older Indigenous students, alumni and professors, it was just heart-wrenching. A lot of Indigenous students just didn't feel comfortable in McGill athletics because of the Redmen name.
McGill history professor Suzanne Morton says that the name was first accompanied by Native imagery in the 1940s.
There's a new football coach hired from the United States, and he wants to make football more spectacle. He wants crowds. And so we have the input of really explicit Indigenous images onto particularly the football team. You have images of fierceness, bravery, savagery. You get new songs which talk horribly about things like scalping and warpath.
New nicknames entered the mix as well. For a while, men's teams were called the Indians. From 1961 until 1976, women's teams were called the Super Squaws. And while all of this was happening, there were hardly any indigenous students on campus to speak out against racism. At the time, legislation called the Indian Act prevented indigenous people from attending college without being kicked off of their reserves. Suzanne Morton says that through her research, she's identified just two indigenous students who graduated from McGill between 1900 and 1960. Pop culture stereotypes were the only exposure most McGill students had to indigeneity.
They see indigenous people in the movies. They may see them on TV with Daniel Boone in the 1950s. But there's no contact with actual people.
Morton says more indigenous people started attending McGill when the Indian Act was amended in the early 60s. But even into the late 80s, Native students made up a tiny part of McGill's student body.
I'm not sure the university even kept reliable statistics in that regard. Less than 1% of 1% is probably the closest numbers.
Ned Blackhawk is a professor of American Indian history at Yale University and a member of the Timok tribe of Western Shoshone Indians of Nevada. In the late 80s, he was an undergrad at McGill. And in his second year, he walked on to the varsity track and field team.
It meant that I was in the gym a lot, and there was a giant Redmond logo above the scoreboard or right alongside it that was probably the size of a fairly large urban billboard. Basically, they had a kind of the side portrait visage of an angry Indian man with a kind of protruding nose and headdress under which it just said Redmond. So it was something I really couldn't avoid. And I didn't really at the time have the vocabulary or set of intellectual commitments to really call into question that image, but it was something that bothered me and something I had to kind of confront.
In 1991, Blackhawk and a fellow undergrad led a campaign to change the Redmond name and remove the Native imagery that came with it.
We wrote opinion editorials for the McGill Daily newspaper. We were interviewed on the McGill University radio station. We held teach-ins. We were just basically involved in sets of kind of consciousness-raising efforts.
And in March of 1992, McGill's athletics board decided to get rid of the Redmond logo. The billboard-sized Indian head in the gym went away. The football and hockey helmets were changed to sport the McGill crest. But the Redmond name stayed. In press releases that March, the chair of the athletics board expressed his belief that getting rid of offensive imagery was enough to disassociate the name from its derogatory connotation. Ned Blackhawk and other indigenous students felt differently.
Seeing that image taken down or removed over time, seeing these things dropped from the hockey team or the football helmets did bring me a sense of satisfaction, though I wish they had come up with a different name.
In recent decades, Canadians have faced their country's history of Native oppression and its lasting consequences. And in 2015, the Canadian government's Truth and Reconciliation Commission underscored the importance of education in creating a more just society for Indigenous peoples and culture. The McGill Provost Office formed a task force on Indigenous studies and education shortly after. When it published its 52 calls to action in 2017, replacing the Redmond name made the list. But a year went by. Tomas Jerusik was finishing up his sophomore season on the crew team, and he says it didn't seem like McGill was taking any real steps towards change. So he and some other students decided to take action.
Out of, Indigenous student activists here at McGill, I was the only athlete at the time. With me being a varsity athlete, I felt that it was something I could really push.
Tomas spoke to news outlets and moderated panel discussions with Indigenous experts. He started speaking to fellow athletes. And he organized a rally to support the name change. On the morning of October 31st, 2018, demonstrators gathered at one of the main gates on McGill's campus.
I remember it being absolutely frigid. And I remember panicking because it was cold. And since it was raining, I needed to secure tents because we had traditional drummers coming. And then once the demonstration kind of took off, after I had kind of gotten over all the small hiccups, I kind of just flew by. It was exhilarating, really. To see in the cold, hundreds and hundreds of students had come. Somewhere between 700 and 800 people had come to see it. And it was just so powerful. It was nice looking up into the crowd and seeing so many of my teammates there, doing everything they really could to support me.
Twice a year, McGill University holds a referendum period where students get to vote on various issues. Tomas and some fellow student legislators had entered the Redmond name change for consideration this past fall. On November 13th, the results were announced.
80% of the student body had voted yes to changing the name. This made McGill better. It really did.
McGill's student referenda aren't binding. After the vote, McGill formed a renaming council that would decide how to move forward. Its report, released in December, quoted advocates for change, and it also quoted alumni who opposed the movement. The report describes a town hall meeting in which
a former varsity athlete compared the team name to a family name, highlighting its role in emotional attachment, social identity, and self-esteem. A jointly signed submission expressed attachment to the Redmond name so strong that the writers vowed that if the name were changed, they would never again donate to McGill, they would discourage their children from applying to McGill, they would consider McGill dead to them, and might actively work against its success.
I was at the First People's House, and there were some first-year students who had been reading the report, and I just remember seeing them cry. Because here are these people who were trying to support this academic institution, and they stand in opposition to reconciliation to such a degree that they would actively undermine the institution if it chose to take the necessary steps in creating a healthy and welcoming environment for Indigenous students.
McGill was expected to announce a final decision on the Redmond name by the end of January. But on January 30th, the university unexpectedly postponed the decision to the end of the spring term. Suzanne Morton says that with such resounding support from students and faculty on campus, she still thinks a name change is likely to happen. If not now, eventually.
I think it means that the university understands where we are right now, who is us, and us includes Indigenous students, and it means that there's a future where hopefully more Indigenous students will feel very welcome here.
For Here and Now, I'm Matthew Stock.
And Matthew comes to us from NPR's terrific Only a Game. Amazon's breakup with New York City last week, scrapping plans for headquarters there, has become a rallying cry for some on the left. Now, Amazon promised 25,000 new jobs. In exchange, the city offered $3 billion in tax incentives. And there were critics in the city. They wanted Amazon to kick in maybe some new infrastructure or maybe hire people from public housing, which is reportedly why Amazon backed out, knowing they can get those tax advantages elsewhere. Democratic Senator and 2020 hopeful Elizabeth Warren called those incentives taxpayer bribes in a tweet. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, also a potential 2020 hopeful, congratulated New Yorkers for standing up to Amazon. But Ohio Democratic Congressman Tim Ryan wrote a letter to Amazon on Friday asking the company to consider setting up shop there. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us as he does every Monday from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hello.
So talk first of all about this reaction. What does it tell us about what's happening in the Democratic Party, if anything?
I think it's so, so fascinating. You know, every party, every social movement really has two identities. What are you against and what are you for? I think it's easy to say right now what the Democratic Party is against. They're against Trump. They're against cutting taxes for the rich. That's obvious. But what are they for? And what we see in this Amazon fight is a bundle of leftist causes that I think a lot of the media is mistaking for like a monolith. Mm. This is actually a really diverse group on the left.
Right.
Some of these people are just anti-gentrification in Queens, right? It's one of those all politics is local things. This is just about public housing in Queens. Some of the people who are rooting against Amazon are anti-monopolists like Elizabeth Warren. They want to bring the fight to big companies. They want to break up these big companies so that they can unleash the forces of the free market. And then others, frankly, like me, are happy this thing happened because we're against corporate welfare. We're against paying billions of dollars to a trillion-dollar company like Amazon just to beg them not to create new jobs in America but just drag jobs from Seattle to New York City. So this fight brought all of us together, but other fights are going to isolate these various strands of the Democratic Party and help the media see exactly what strain of leftism is strongest.
Well, sometimes you can get it all in one person. You've got New York Mayor Bill de Blasio, who's so – he says he's dead set against what he calls economic warfare, these tax incentives so that states and cities that might be like-minded have to battle each other to offer these tax incentives to woo these companies. But on the other hand, he was a supporter of the deal. But on the other hand, he blamed Amazon for walking away. You know, he and others said, hey, this is New York. If you can't take some critics, you know, or people asking for a little bit extra. He also expressed frustration with the Democrats who spoke out against the deal. Here he is on WNYC's Brian Lehrer Show Friday.
I'll take on any progressive anywhere that thinks it's a good idea to lose jobs and revenue, because I think that's out of touch with what working people want.
You know, and Derek, he said, I want to see something different, even though he was for this deal because of the jobs it was going to bring. It gets complicated.
Oh, yeah, it gets very complicated. I think, you know, on Amazon's part, I understand why they pulled out of this. I think in many ways the reason that Amazon opened up the HQ2 sweepstakes in the first place was because they didn't want to work with a local government that was against the company the way that Seattle has turned against Amazon. And in many ways, I think they just saw Queens coming to resemble the Seattle local governance.
Well, you know, I'm going to just jump in. I'm going to jump in for people who aren't following this. The reason Seattle's many there have turned against Amazon is that the city council there wanted to pass a tax on big employers to fund homelessness, a battle against homelessness. The company threatened to stop major expansion plans that would put 7,000 jobs at risk. The tax was rescinded. People say that's too much power.
Exactly. And I think that a lot of people who were against Amazon moving into New York City understood, yes, maybe this is a lot of high-paying new jobs. Yes, we can make revenue from the wage taxes and from their sales taxes. But we want to work with a company that is famous for working with local governments to improve the city, not a company that is, at least in Seattle, infamous for the opposite. I think there's a really, really strong point, though, to be made here, that New York City does not have an employment problem. There are more jobs in New York City than there have ever been, and tech is expanding at a rapid clip in the city. New York doesn't have an employment problem. It has a household affordability problem. Mm-hmm. And local governance should take on the household affordability problem in New York City so that it becomes the kind of place that any company wants to go to, even without a $3 billion ransom.
Well, this again, staying with politics, we got about a minute here. What's happening on the right? Because you have conservative strategist Steve Levy writing on FoxNews.com that New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her, quote, radical business-hating minions played a supporting role in this and, you know, trying to leverage this as, you know, finger-pointing at what the right is really hoping people will view as a very radical left. So there's a lot of political points to be scored here.
There are a lot of political points to be scored here, and I just want to end by clarifying a schism that I think exists in the left that has been underreported by the media. And that is that you have, say, the Elizabeth Warren wing of the party and the AOC Democratic Socialist wing. Mm-hmm. Warren wants to break up large companies in order to free up the energies of the free market, to create more private enterprise, create more innovation. But you also have on the far left, I think, a real interest in moving the U.S. towards socialism, moving the toward full-blown socialism, toward controlling the means of the economy, taking over big companies and turning them into essentially the equivalent of what we saw with sort of the bells of the 1950s, yeah, government-sanctioned monopolies. So that is a really important schism, I think, to look at in the future of the Democratic Party.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And this is Here and Now. Jeremy Hobson is off today. I'm Robin Young. You're listening to Here and Now.